Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. On this podcast, we present a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The presentation is entitled The Business of Music on Campus and Off, a conversation with Carrie Sherman about today's modern music marketplace. Our speaker is Carrie Sherman, Chairman and CEO for the Recording Industry Association of America.
Hello, everyone. So you've heard my name is Carrie Sherman. I'm CEO of the Recording Industry Association of America. And I suspect that RAA is pretty well known on college campuses, at least judging by the sales of toilet paper. I guess some people think our reputation is a little crappy. I don't even know if this is two-ply, but we're still trying to figure out how to get royalties off this. I assure you that most of what you read about us online is not true. For example, this is not true. Also, this is not true. Our lawyers did not track down Osama bin Laden. But this one does happen to be true. So I'm at a university conference. You know, we just had to think about some courses that we should suggest for you to offer for your students, at least courses that RAA has been thinking about these days. These are can't-miss courses, but, you know, trust me on this. Big future for vinyl. We're looking forward to it. I hope you all know about Mega Upload and what an evil organization they are. Our reputation on campus certainly would make this an interesting course. And there's the old using litigation to put the genie back in the bottle. And, of course, the best course of all, how to advocate for SOPA and PIPA. So if I can help you after the talk with organizing any of these courses, please just let me know. I'd like to turn to the real stuff because it was very kind of you to invite me to talk about the modern music business. And I think the music industry really has a great story to tell, and I hope it's one that you will want to hear. The bottom line is that the music industry today has transformed how it does business, and I'd like to just give you five facts that you should know about the modern music business. And in the course of that, I'd like to talk a little bit about how universities have intersected with the music industry. The first point is that the music industry is now primarily digital. That's right. CDs are no longer our primary source of revenue. Digital is not just our future, it is our present. In 2004, the first year we had real digital revenues, the industry earned about $190 million from digital services. Last year, we earned nearly $3.5 billion. That's quite a change in 7 years. And by the way, the music business is way ahead of our sister industries transitioning to digital, way ahead. And this is not just in the United States, but all around the world. We used to hear that we needed to get a new business model. Well, our companies have done just that. You want DRM-free downloads? We've got lots of those. You want to pay a small monthly fee for a subscription to unlimited music on your computer or smartphone? We've got that, too. You want free ad-supported streaming? We got that, too. And I missed a page. Music bundled with your mobile phones. That is increasingly common. You want to store all your music in the cloud so you can access it from anywhere. You can do that now. You want specialized digital radio services. There are lots available. You want your AM/FM radio stations online available as well. All these business models have been embraced and licensed by the major music companies. In fact, there are over 500 digital music services authorized by our member companies worldwide, offering 26 million authorized tracks. And by the way, this is an industry that hasn't traditionally relied on windowing for its releases. So if you have complaints about getting to see Game of Thrones, that's not us. And when pundits tell you that there wouldn't be piracy if content people just made their stuff available, that isn't music either. We really have put everything online. And we're doing more. One of our highest priorities is to develop the infrastructure that will make it faster and easier to offer even more innovative models to fans. Just this past April, we announced, along with music publishers and a large number of digital music services, a groundbreaking licensing agreement that will make it easier for digital services to clear rights for new models. We're also working on new industry-wide databases and royalty distribution systems to make the whole royalty payment process more efficient, and we're in the process of negotiating reforms to the existing licensing system for musical works. We are committed to making it easier for entrepreneurs to offer even more innovative services to music fans. The third point I bring up, just because I find it interesting and because it's counterintuitive. You probably know that historically, very few albums have accounted for the vast majority of sales. That was true for many decades. But what you may not know is that it remains true today. Last year, 2% of albums accounted for 89% of sales. Clearly, the internet has created untold opportunities to distribute music easily and cheaply. In fact, some 77,000 albums were produced last year, were released in 2011. But most of those albums barely sold at all. 80% sold fewer than 100 copies. 94% sold less than 1,000. So for all the opportunities for niche, specialized genres of music to find its fans, and for all the deep catalog made available online, what's most downloaded is still the most popular stuff. And it's not just sales, by the way. The streaming charts tend to mirror the sales charts. So no matter which way the music is accessed, it's still the most popular stuff. And for those who thought, therefore, that music labels in this new world were going to become irrelevant or unnecessary, it really just hasn't worked out that way. When there is so much music available, when anybody can put their stuff up and out and up on the internet, the role of a label as a curator of talent becomes that much more important. And that makes sense. Music labels are to emerging artists what venture capital companies are to tech startups. They decide which are the most promising and in which they're going to invest their money, their human resources, their time in helping them make it. Certainly, artists are now able to attain success on their own, and we welcome a marketplace where they have that opportunity, but labels matter. They not only hone the talent of emerging artists, they also market and promote them to create demand for their music, and judging by the data I've just shown you, the labels, whether they're major labels or indie labels, are doing their jobs very well. You all know that we've complained loudly about the illegal downloading of music. Let me just make a few points about that. As a business, we're half the size we used to be, nearly $15 billion in 1999, down to $7 billion in 2011. Is that decline entirely due to illegal downloading? I don't think so. A lot of factors played a role, including marketplace developments like selling individual tracks and not just albums. That's changed the economics of the business a lot. Is every illegal download a lost sale? Of course not. But nearly every academic study and nearly every economist, not to mention common sense, has concluded that illegal downloading has hurt us. We can argue over how much harm, but the fact of harm cannot really be disputed. There are fewer artists on our rosters, less money to invest in artists, massive layoffs. And of course, it is true that file sharing services can be used for perfectly legitimate purposes. We've been saying that from the beginning. It's not an issue. But let's also be honest about it. The overwhelming majority are using it to infringe. A study of BitTorrent by Invisional in 2011 looked at the top 10,000 torrents. About 36% were porn. No surprise there. And about 64% were copyrighted works. Identified works that were not copyrighted, 0.01%. And a similar study was done by Professor Ed Felton, who concluded that about 1% of a sample of BitTorrent files were likely non-infringing. So it's not surprising that our sales would be down. But probably the most important fact, yet the least known, is that fewer people today are actually trying to make a living from music. According to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, from the federal government, the number of people who identify themselves as musicians has declined over the last decade. Between August 1999 being the magic year of Napster, and August of 2012, there's been a decline of 37% in people working as musicians. And you can see how the trend line conspicuously tracks the decline of the industry. So obviously, piracy is not just a problem for our economy, it's a problem for our culture. And that's why professional musicians care about piracy. They care about it not just because of its impact on their own incomes, but also because of its impact on new artists, on the ability of amateurs to become professionals, and on music itself. When it comes to protecting or enforcing creative rights, the effort is often caricatured as a game of whack-a-mole where the only winners are the lawyers. And believe me, I can appreciate that skepticism. But lately, fresh evidence is emerging that the impact can actually be quite beneficial. Strategic copyright enforcement can actually deter would-be illegal downloaders and put money into the pockets of artists and songwriters and labels and publishers. You're all familiar with LimeWire. Between 2007 and 2010, about two-thirds of file sharers used LimeWire. A federal court finally shut them down for inducing massive copyright infringement at the end of October 2010. The very next month, after LimeWire was shut down, digital sales improved, and they've remained higher ever since. I don't think that's a coincidence. Two market research firms have released surveys showing that the number of P2P users dropped significantly and that more than half the people who had used LimeWire did not go to another illegal music site to get their music after the shutdown. In other words, enforcing rights can actually help move consumers from illegal to legal consumption. The same conclusion emerged from an academic study on the impact of Hadopi in France. In case you haven't heard about it, France has enacted a graduated response law under which Internet subscribers who repeatedly infringe using peer-to-peer file sharing after two warnings can either be fined or have their Internet access suspended. Professors Brett Danaher of Wellesley and Mike Smith of Carnegie Mellon undertook a very interesting economic analysis of the impact of the law. And they found that the mere enactment of the law and the attendant publicity had a significant impact. iTunes album sales increased by 25% just as a result of enactment of the law before even any of the processes had begun. And consider what happened with Mega Upload. That is one of the most important and strategic enforcement actions of all time, the criminal indictment of Mega Upload. You know, rogue cyber locker services will basically operate just like any other pirate operator. They will continue running the service, knowing that there's risk, because they'll just, you know, when they're sued in civil court, they will just have the, you know, they'll pay the lawyers and keep earning money and put the money away and hide it while they're litigating. And if someday they're shut down, so be it. But when you're indicted for a criminal offense, when you are actually facing jail time, it tends to focus the mind. And the Mega Upload indictment focused the minds of all the other major rogue cyber locker services. Of the top eight such services, seven either closed down, disabled sharing, or introduced filtering, dramatically eliminating or reducing infringement on their services. Now, that's strategic enforcement. In the end, the single most important strategy for anti-piracy remains innovation, experimenting, working with our technology partners on consumer-friendly new business models, and giving consumers what they want. But enforcing rights is a necessary complementary strategy, too. So we're frequently asked, what are our strategies going forward? And the answer is to do exactly what we have been doing for the last 3-4 years now, which is to forge voluntary marketplace agreements with others in the Internet ecosystem under which everyone plays a part in addressing the piracy problem. Just last year, we announced a voluntary program with ISPs to address illegal downloads on P2P networks, a program that will launch very soon. We also helped craft an agreement with major credit card companies on voluntary best practices to reduce sales of counterfeit and pirated goods. A few months ago, major advertisers and ad agencies announced a series of voluntary best practices so that their valuable brands would not be associated with rogue websites and advertisers don't inadvertently enrich rogue website operators. These programs are not a panacea, no program ever will be, but collectively we think that these collaborative efforts can make a difference. They are also the product of a lot of outreach and a lot of conversation over several years, not only with these intermediaries, but with civil society groups who want to figure out how to address online problems while ensuring the preservation of a free and open Internet. We need to engage in the same sort of dialogue with the tech community and the Internet community. I am committed to doing that because in the end, I think we all have an interest in an Internet that is open and free, but not lawless. Just a quick word about our commercial ISP deal because it will be launching within literally a week or two. It covers music and movies, and we're working with AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and Cablevision. It's completely voluntary. It creates a new entity to oversee the program to ensure that the technologies used in the program are validated, to set up a process for independent review when notices are challenged, and to provide education to the public. And the program is primarily educational. It's only after getting maybe 5 or even more notices that an ISP may implement a mitigation measure, such as reducing bandwidth temporarily or requiring review of some educational materials, and it's up to the ISP to decide what to do. Why are we optimistic that this approach might actually work? Because of our experience with you. Colleges and universities really were the original intermediary. It was the first outreach we made when we were trying to address the piracy problem. And I would like to convey a very simple message, which is thanks. We probably haven't said it enough, so let me say it now. You have been very, very good partners, and EDUCAUSE in particular has done great work as a clearinghouse of information and a well-respected source of information, and we're very grateful. I probably don't need to spend too much time detailing the various steps that different colleges have taken. You can see on this slide the different types of ideas and approaches. In truth, universities have been the testing ground for the graduated response programs, each school developing its own particular form of escalating notices or sanctions or whatever. For some, it's a fine. For others, it's community service. It's different at every school. And whether you've been using education or technological tools or some sort of consequences for repeat offenders or all of them, it has made a difference. If you take a look at this slide, you'll see a sampling of universities that have experienced a noticeable drop in the number of DMCA notices that we have sent to them. There might be a variety of reasons for this. They don't share with us what they're doing. We're just looking at that we're sending a lot fewer notices to these schools. This is not a scientific barometer, but it's very suggestive about how much difference actions can take. And I also, again, want to thank EDUCAUSE because of the information that it has provided for all of you about university file sharing policies, best practices, and the like. Here are some examples, and as I said, we're grateful. So I spent a lot of time at the beginning of this presentation talking about all the new business models that the music industry has embraced, because I wanted to convey that we are really trying to make a difference in terms of the legal marketplace. We know that's job number one, and I hope that you and your colleagues appreciate that illegal file sharing is not just our problem, because even though we may need to lead the way, some of your peers increasingly recognize that there are real benefits to you, too, when you undertake some steps. And here are some quotes from officials, university officials attesting to that. Obviously, we've done a lot of work on campuses, but one less well-known aspect is I work directly with college marketing programs and college students. We don't know the answers, and that's why the best way is to actually engage students to ask their peers. So I wanted to highlight two projects for you, including the creative that was produced in those classes, just for your information or because you may be curious. The first is Adventure, where we work directly with senior-level marketing classes at five different universities. This is the work of college students based on their own research with their fellow students. And here are some examples of the messages that they developed. They appeared on university newspapers and bulletin boards, you name it. And it's interesting because they came to the conclusion that the emphasis on personal consequences was the most important component when talking to other students. The RA also supported work by professors at Syracuse University to better understand college student behavior, and their findings were just published last month. Broadly, the studies found, and you won't be shocked by this, college students had very few qualms about downloading music illegally, and there was no or very little social stigma attached to it, even though most students knew it was against the law. The projects also tested what messages would be most effective with students, and they found that messages that emphasized the negative personal consequences that could occur were most effective. Fines, lawsuits, trouble getting a job if it got onto their student record, computer viruses, those are the things that might make a difference. Their work and their messaging is actually very impressive, and it was very thoughtfully done. And, you know, the students love working on this stuff. It's a great issue. So if any of these ads are of interest to you, we're happy to get them to you in case you have any desire to use them on your campus. So we've talked about the various digital music services, we've talked about the music business, education and enforcement strategies, but ultimately, and this is where we really want to be going now, it's all about the music. A lot of the emphasis on enforcement is more historical than present, and I'm delighted about that, because music is the defining thing about this industry, and certainly about RAAA, and as a force in culture. More music is being consumed now than ever before, and music really matters more than ever before. Of the top 10 most followed people on Twitter, 7 are music artists. Of the top 12 videos on YouTube, 11 are music. Music is an important driver of smartphone sales and a key part of the smartphone experience. In fact, devices are beginning to compete based not on the device itself, but on the content it can deliver. So music really remains a centrifugal force in culture and commerce, and it's only going to get stronger. It's worth creating, it's worth protecting, and we're going to continue to work hard to make it available in new and better ways. Thanks for listening.
So Carrie's happy to take questions, and I suppose happy to take comments and whatever. And I know we have an online interlocutor here as well, so there may be some there out watching through that machine up here. And if you have a question, please go, as this gentleman has, to a microphone.
Hi. Rich Kogut, UC Merced. As a somewhat guitar player myself, I looked at your slide about the declining number of professional musicians. And one thing I know, all the people I work with, is there's a declining number of gigs. They make their money from live performances, not from, you know, selling albums. And the advent of the DJ and all of that has made it really a big reason why there are a lot fewer musicians. So I don't know what part of that is related to digital rights and that area. There's very few people that make a fortune, ever have made a fortune recording and selling them. So.
He'll get you.
We're simply drawing the line and showing what the BLS data show. We are not trying to explain it. We have not done regression analyses or anything else. It's probably a big fact. But it's interesting how it tracked the fortunes of the industry, because DJs have been around a long time. It hasn't just been the last few years. This is over a 1999 to 2012 period. It's interesting. It's worthy of more investigation.
On those same lines, you said at the end that more music is now being consumed than ever. And earlier in the presentation, you showed that the overall revenue has declined precipitously over the last dozen years or so. Given that prices haven't really come down for recorded music, how do you explain the change?
Well, first of all, prices have dramatically come down for recorded music. Wholesale prices, retail prices are a fraction of what they were. 15 and $20 CDs are now $10. So it's enormously cheaper. And, of course, the fact that people can buy tracks. So even legally, the prices have come down. But it's the illegal consumption. There are more people consuming music than ever before, but fewer and fewer people are paying for it. So we're now at about, I think, 36%, 38%, I don't remember the exact number, are paying for music, and the rest is acquired illegally. The ways that it's acquired illegally differ, but we're trying to move to models where illegal consumption doesn't matter as much. Certainly illegal downloading shouldn't matter as much. If you get into subscription models where people pay monthly fees for their services, or streaming models which are ad-supported, and so on and so forth, you can have revenues coming in where it feels like free to the consumer, and therefore people have no reason to go to an illegal site to get their music any longer.
Is there an online question?
Yes, we do have an online question. Vicky Klein asks, you are developing wonderful models for individuals. What about models for libraries wanting to make materials available for classroom and educational use?
I hadn't realized that music was that big an item for libraries making available for educational use. I believe that libraries have access to both digital music services and physical product that can be used under very generous licenses and existing law for classroom purposes quite freely. So I'm just not familiar enough with that market to really comment on it. Sorry.
Thank you.
Two questions from now. You'll probably hear from someone who is, but please.
Hi. I had a question about an earlier slide that I found interesting, but I didn't understand what the point was. That was
could you
the slide that said of newly released albums, less than 1,000 sold.
Right.
I didn't understand the point of that slide, but I was interested in it.
Okay. If you go back, say, to the late 90s, there were probably an average of 35,000 albums released a year, some years 30,000, some years 37,000, somewhere in that range between independent labels and major record labels. That's how many were produced. Now, anybody can put out an album. Any musician can go into his bedroom and with really good recording equipment make a really fine product that can then be digitally uploaded to iTunes or can be put on any number of other online services, or he can burn CDs and actually sell them at gigs or, you know, in any other venue. So there are a lot more albums being released. There's been a proliferation of new music, and going from like 30 or 37,000 to 77,000 gives you an idea of the magnitude of the increase. And the 77,000 is actually a reduction. We had 105,000 albums released a couple of years before that. The problem is that there isn't much demand for them because the people who are creating them don't also have the opportunity to actually be the marketers and the business people to actually make a living as a musician. So there is so much content out there that the role of the record label becomes critically important in terms of choosing which albums to promote, to market, to try and create the demand. And that's why, even though we should be having this long tail, this proliferation of everybody can get exactly the kind of music they want, 89% of the sales are still just 2% of the releases. And all those 77,000, 80% sold less than 100 copies. That's really a small number of copies. That was my point.
Hi, I'm Cliff Lynch. You just actually answered one of the questions I was going to ask. I was fascinated by those numbers as well, and just how thin that level of audience is out there. But I have another question I wanted to ask. It's my sense, and I certainly don't have anything quantitative here, that over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a tremendous amount of historical material from the last 50 years showing up in various venues, most notably probably YouTube. Various performances that were captured by some television station or various private documentaries, all sorts of things like that. Has there been some business change that has facilitated that, or is that just a sort of an accidental byproduct of the availability of services like YouTube?
I'm going to guess it's more a collateral impact of more people are finding things to upload, not because I don't think there is a lot of business reason to be putting that stuff on YouTube. All of the record companies have licensed YouTube, so when they play music videos and so on, those are licensed performances, and they do earn revenues for the labels and the artists. It's a rev share basis, so it's all free to the consumer and so on. Of course, the system has been gamed quite a bit. It's supposed to be basically that these are user-generated content videos. That's basically what's supposed to be going up onto YouTube, where people are lip-syncing to, you know, a famous artist's song or in their bedrooms or whatever. But what some people are doing is putting on the actual discography, and then they'll put a picture of Bob Dylan, for example, just a still photo, and that's the YouTube video. And so anybody who wants to hear Bob Dylan can find anything that they want on YouTube, and the payments that are being made are a fraction of a cent, and therefore they're competing with streaming services that are really trying to be really in the music business as opposed to a collateral business like the YouTube music videos are. So it wouldn't be record companies that are unearthing these things in order to get a little bit of additional ad share revenue. It's more likely that it's more people who love the old stuff who are finding it and putting it up. And by the way, the Smithsonian has had quite a collection, and some of the record companies are contributing their old materials, and that's all available for streaming now, and it's an unbelievable collection of material.
Yeah, I mean, there's some wonderful stuff surfacing. The sorts of things I'm thinking of are not substitutables for anything that was on the marketplace, but
right.
Typically, you know, some live performance that hasn't been seen in 30 or 40 years. So from your point of view, that stuff is just kind of surfacing,
and it's
not
a great
much
thing.
Structural.
Frankly, we like anything that promotes more interest in music. The more people can find, the more excited they become by music, the happier we are.
Thank you.
And I'll call on you in a moment, but let me do my EDUCAUSE duty and remind you that if you go to e12feedback.com, we would really appreciate when we're done with the session if you would fill out an evaluation, whatever your value is, that will help us. Having said that, please.
Okay. Yeah. I'm David Norm from Bentley University. I was just curious. One of your slides earlier, you showed that the music industry is kind of far and away ahead in terms of downloaded content than, say, books or movies. But I guess we've got to assume that the publishing industry and the movie industry is going to go the same way as the music industry in the next few years. What you've been through since 1999, I mean, what would your advice be to book publishers, other media providers, in terms of what you've learned from your experience in the music industry, as to how they can deal with the changes that are going to happen to them too?
That's a really good question. It would require a really long answer. But the shortest piece of advice is obviously to get ahead of the curve. We had a period of a few years from maybe 1997 till beginning of 2001, 2002, but it really wasn't until the iTunes Store began in 2003 that legal music was really easy to get online. That is way too long a period for only illegal sources. And it isn't as though there weren't efforts. There was a major project done with IBM where it was a download store, and then the major record labels formed two different consortia to develop music subscription services. One was called MusicNet, another Press Play. They did a terrible job at it. Record companies should be making music. They shouldn't be getting into the technology business. Apple should be in the technology business. And when they did it, everyone saw how it should be done. Everybody knows now that you have to get ahead of the curve. And there is really no excuse, therefore, for not making sure that really good, simple, attractive technologies are in place with, the right business deals to get that stuff on the market as quickly as possible. You do not want to create an underground economy before the legal economy starts.
All right, I'm going to sneak a question in. So I have a brother-in-law who's a lawyer, and the brother-in-law has two sons, and he very much wanted them to be lawyers. And one of them has made his father very happy because he is a lawyer, and he followed, and he went to the same college and did all the things right. The other one, despite a great deal of pressure, decided that he wanted to be a musician. And so he had a band for a while, and he's actually a bit of a composer, and he's had a couple of hits, so he actually gets real live royalties. But he realized that maybe that wasn't the life in the long run, and so he now works a lot on the production side. And his father's on his case all the time, and then periodically calls me and says, you work in this field, tell Mark that there's no future in this. He really someday has to get on with the real career. So the question is, what's your advice for the Marks of the world who want to be in this industry? I mean, do they have hope?
I give ask this a lot, actually, by parents. And the advice that I give is you should only be a musician if you have to be a musician. It is a very tough business. It is a pyramidal business. Everybody knows it's a pyramidal business. The people at the top do very, very well, and then the next level they do okay. But then you get down to, the heart-wrenching stories about the musicians who got caught in this hurricane in New York, who were living from hand to mouth, and they're able to pay rent, but they now didn't have food, and because the gig was canceled and they were relying on the gig to have food. That's a very tough life. So you only do it if you really have to do it. And I often will say, give it 10 years or whatever number of years you need to try and make it. And very often you will wind up moving into some part of the industry that you didn't expect. You start off as an artist and you wind up in marketing at a record label, or you wind up at an online company that's actually a website for artists to put their work out, or you wind up doing producing. The point is that you can love that and it can be a great job, but you need to find where your niche is going to be. But don't even start there unless you are totally drawn to the music.
Yeah, fortunately, his wife does game development for Disney aimed at young women, which is a huge growth market.
That's great.
Is there an online question?
An online comment back from our original person here. Vicky is thinking that she's the lonely voice crying in the wilderness when she says, "This isn't a question for the speaker, just a comment for other attendees. Streaming options in libraries are almost entirely limited to classical and archival records. If a professor is teaching a course about the evolution of American popular music, either we must purchase the CDs and make the students come into the library to listen, or the students have to purchase individual tracks for their classes listening." An FYI.
I'm familiar with a company that was actually offering streaming services to universities. That was what he was specializing in, was... And he did a pilot with Georgetown, and he was actually trying to fill exactly this niche. And I think he had the licenses from the companies. He wasn't getting interest from the universities. So I don't know what to tell you.
And part of this, presumably, is the ongoing controversy about exactly what's covered by fair use and what isn't.
Always.
To which there is no simple answer. Sir.
Well, that's a great segue to my question. You talked about some educational initiatives at different universities. Could you talk a little bit about fair use and what you've seen universities do and messages that you all would like for universities to be promoting with respect to fair use and the ways that students can utilize copyrighted works within projects and work that they're doing for school?
You know, the truth is we have stayed away from the fair use issue because to us the fair use issue is a red herring. First of all, copyright owners are strong believers in fair use because everything that we do is built on something else, so we need to have a very robust fair use doctrine to avoid liability ourselves. So we believe in fair use. But fair use has been completely abused to justify almost everything, including downloading entire copyrighted works. It was never intended for that. In fact, we, as part of this ISP program, we have an eminent copyright scholar advising the arbitrators of the American Arbitration Association on how fair use applies to peer-to-peer file sharing. We have basically focused entirely on the full copying of entire works and not on mashups and things like that, because in those cases, fair use is in the eye of the beholder. Some artists are crazy about protecting their work, and others just say, use it, just give me credit. So it is not something that we get into, and we let basically the user and the owner fight it out in the rare case when it actually is a fight.
And interestingly, another of my brother-in-laws is an arbitrator, so we're knocking them off right and left here. Sir.
Well, this is actually a response to the online commenter, and that would be to don't just stick with the lore on your campus, but actually call BMI and ASCAP and I guess RIAA and see what your actual current licensing agreements that you have with these organizations are, because it might well be that you already have licenses available and that you can do things like do live streams. You can also do streaming of material that you own, that the library owns, within limited amounts. So there's more to it than just no.
Yeah, RIAA doesn't do any licensing, by the way. Just
okay, then BMI, call BMI and ASCAP. I think you'd be pleasantly surprised.
There are lots of organizations that do the licensing, but we are not one of them.
Well, it appears we have exhausted inquiry and response. Any last comments you'd like to make?
No, just that I want to repeat what I said earlier. You were the original intermediary, and there were tense times between music companies and university people who didn't like to have to do anything about what was going on. But in the end, it's been a very good relationship and a very respectful one, and we're grateful for it. And you're teaching values. You really are. So you do set a standard by what you do and don't do. And so when you actually do something that basically says something about the ethics of behavior, it's something that should last a lifetime for your students, so thank you for when you do it.
And on behalf of my colleagues in higher education, thank you for those kind words, and thank you for a really excellent presentation and for being with us today.
Thank you.